All right, good evening, everyone. It is Tuesday, February 8th, 2011. We had to postpone the Bait Midgers last week. I was away. Apologize for that. So here, the Tuesday before Valentine's Day, I think Dana was the one who gave me inspiration for this, to put together a sheer on love, trying to focus a little bit more on the romantic love side of Judaism.
Can you stop that for just a second?
Anyway, so back to the Bait Midgers session at hand here. With the discussion of love, as I put in the intro here, the Hebrew word for love is ahava, and more often than not, it's used in reference to God, right? I included here, anyone off the top of their heads, what's the big line? There you go. Right, we have a commandment, or at least there's a dispute about a commandment, whether or not you have an obligation to feel an emotion, but there's a commandment to love God. It sounds like a commandment, at least. Let's assume for the moment it is. But at any rate, you have the statement that we say twice a day in the Shema, that we're supposed to love God with all our heart, all our soul, and all our property. But what does it really mean, ahava? And part of what we're going to do today is see a bit of a semantic range of what the word ahava means and some of the different contexts in which it's used. We're going to focus primarily on the interpersonal ones because you'll find ahava used for things that we wouldn't necessarily consider comparable to love between two different people. For example, if someone, I think we had that with Yitzhak, that we'll see a little bit of Yitzhak a little bit later, but one of the things that we're told he loves was the meat. And yet, we don't consider, I would very much hope that the way we love our spouse isn't the same way we love a piece of steak. I'm not going to make any American Pie references now, but maybe you haven't. Point is here, you've got, this word ahava that takes on really diverse meanings. And what we're going to try to do today is extrapolate what might this word mean based on the semantic range of it. Because, words do have meanings. And, if you're trying to say, well, what does it mean to love God or have a sense of ahava for God? Well, what does it mean to have a sense of ahava at all? I mean, love can obviously mean different things to different people. So we're going to look today and see some ways that Torah use this really amorphous concept called love. So, Dana, first source here, apologize for not numbering them because I thought people would do these together, this is Bereshit Chaf Bet Aleph and Bet 22:1-2.
This is the Akedah.
Right. This is the very first time the root Ahava, Aleph Hey Bet, is used in the Torah.
Before we start on Ahava, I noticed this, we're just concentrating on that root.
Correct.
Other roots that also...
There are a couple of other words, certainly in... Right, so the word Chovev does appear a little bit more in Rabbinic Judaism. There's actually one of the sources we have here doesn't use the term Ahava, but I threw it in because it's a very cute passage. So I wanted to focus more on Ahava because if you're trying to find the meaning of a word, it's best to find other instances of that word and extrapolate as opposed to look at things conceptually, right? Because we're told, v'ahavta t'Hashem Elokecha, right? So, if you're talking about, say, to love God and that's your end, well, where else is ahava used as opposed to, some variant of chaviv or some other, if it's synonymous.
Ahava is the most predominant root that they use for love.
As far as I know, and it takes on a really wide range. Again, referring to objects, referring to peoples, and also different sorts of relationships that could range anything as we're going to see from, just deep friendship to outright lust. Right? So those are things to keep in mind. And they all are, basic liking. Right? Even today, I don't know if, I wish there was a native Israeli speaker here, they invented a new word for like. When I was growing up, Ahav was pretty much like and love.
Right.
Right? There was no distinction there.
Is this a word that's used interpersonally and between man and God?
It's definitely used interpersonally. We're going to try to figure out what does it mean, and perhaps extrapolate to man and God. Most of the stuff that we have here is interpersonal, which is, most of the point of the Beit Midrash. So the very first source is the very first instance of Ahava.
Now,
Go for it.
In 1978... the Eurovision winner for Israel was Abani Bi Ohob El Bohebet Obotabach. So probably street Hebrew, even as far back as 1978 used.
Well, I was 1 year old at the time. I wasn't saying much of anything. Anyway.
Ani ohev otach in... Okay, fine.
Go for it.
Vayi achar ha'dvarim ha'ele v'alim v'alokim nisas Avraham v'yomer elav Avraham v'yomer hineni v'yomer kachnas bimchas yechidcha asher ahavtes yitzchak v'lech v'chor al eretz ha'moriah v'aleiv sham le'ola al achad he'harim asher amrei lecha. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Then God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah, and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you.
All right, so the question I included here is, aside from the obvious context of being commanded to sacrifice one's son, What do you find unusual about this first time that Ahav is used in terms of at all?
In Hebrew, it's in the past tense.
Okay, in the past tense, meaning all right.
That's interesting that you loved your son.
Isn't it interesting? Isn't it? Never mind.
It's like he's already dead.
Well, yichidecha, you know. Really the possessive. Because it's a share. A share ahavta could very mean that. I'm not so sure if it's necessary here that it's a perfect.
Well, I know the verb yodea, when it's in the past tense, it has a present meaning as well, because once you know something, you can. I don't know if there's a similar principle.
This sounds really embarrassing. I'm going to have to check my lambda when I get home. It's been too long since I've done the ins and outs of biblical Hebrew. But you are picking up something very interesting here. All right, let's assume, you know, it's a past tense. What do you think that we're missing here?
I mean, I don't think this is at all what you're talking about, but it's odd to me. Maybe this is a 21st century thinking that the first instance of love is not between Abraham and Isaac.
Mm-hmm. That's a fantastic point.
Maybe marriage was a practical and, you know, being different, mm-hmm.
That's a great point. We'll look at that in the next source, but it's definitely a great idea to put a pin in. Let's just say with Avram and Yitzchak, right, just with this one line here.
Mm.
Anything find something strange with this? That this being the first time. I'll give you a hint. Who's the speaker?
God.
So what are we missing?
That Abraham.
We're missing an explicit pasuk that Abraham loved Isaac. Right? There's no pasuk that says Avram ohevet Yitzchak. It's something
really
which
necessary though.
Why do we need that? God's already telling us.
Again, this is a good point to consider. You're saying, is it really necessary? Under the assumption, flesh it out.
The implication is that he does?
Yeah. The implication is simply, someone's going to love his kid. Right? Such that we don't need to be told it.
But wait a minute.
But rather, God is the one who says, take the son which you love. Yeah.
Isn't there a whole... I forgot where it comes from, but isn't there mm-hmm. commentary where... Kachnez bincha, God, I have two sons.
Right.
As yechidcha.
Yep.
Right? And asher ahavta. Well, the one you love.
I love them both. And he says that Yitzchak. Yes, very well said. Yeah, that's the midrash on this pasuk. However, you know, even, you know, setting that as so that would sort of take us a step further to say, well, even by implication, ahava is something that should be automatic, or at least there's certain relationships that it should be taken as a given. That a parent loves his kid. Not something to consider here, but the very first time that it's used is used more as a referent, where God's telling him, take the son that you love, as opposed, or it could be, take the son which you love. Lawyer?
Whom you love.
Whom you love, thank you. Because I know there's a huge fight about that. Take the son whom you love, right, Yitzchak, but we're never actually told explicitly that Avram loved Yitzchak. Now you can say, now if you want to say that it should be understood, well then what about all the other instances of Ahava that would have to be, you know, then every other time it's mentioned, you'd have to think, well, is it really necessary? If it's obvious, then it shouldn't be said, such that when it is said, maybe it wasn't obvious.
I don't know if you need to apply like a universal rule to the situation, mm-hmm. because it's one way here. I think that it seems like it's being used here more as a foil to mm-hmm. the next sentence, which is that he's going to sacrifice him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to sort of give context to the fact that he's offering up his son as a sacrifice, not on, it's not just like a possession of his, or, you know, livestock or something, but a son which you love.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're saying that part of this is for dramatic effect.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Well, also, the Torah doesn't waste words. We know that. If God's already saying it, there's really no need to say it prior to that, because then there's really no need to state it beforehand.
The rules of the principle that you're saying goes, you know, the Torah doesn't waste words. There's a fancy term for it called omnisignificance, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, every little thing has significance or is important, such that they aren't wasted. The rules are somewhat complicated behind what that exactly how that works.
Okay.
You know, because you do have certain redundancies, but that'll get, you know, I can understand why you would say that. But
just,
you know, going back to Jacob's point, if it's implicit, we shouldn't be told that anyone loved anyone else at all, unless it's otherwise necessary to be informed of this fact. Meaning, we ought to assume that, say, all husbands love their wives, right? Otherwise, why are you telling us? You know, it's, again, something to consider here. This is only the first source.
Okay.
Let me take the second source. This is the first time that Ahava is used in what we would consider to be called romantic love, but we'll see that it's kind of unusual. You can just read the English if the Hebrew is difficult. It's from Bereshit 24:67.
Isaac brought her into the tent of his married Rebekah, loved her, and Isaac was comforted.
Mm. What do you think about this one?
He used the love of Rivka to be consoled by his about his mother's death.
Mm. Yeah, that is kind of unusual, isn't it?
That's a weird rebound. It's a sort of...
Well, he's assuming that he married her in order to, you know, become comforted. Meaning, it's not necessarily there's a motivation behind it as much as, you know, a correlation. It's hard to say that there, you know, that goes back to your correlation causation thing there. You know, it could be that the ahava that he felt for her comforted him. Maybe that was intentional, maybe it wasn't. You know, I don't. It certainly doesn't seem that that was the purpose of marrying Rivka, is, you know, to have kids, which is why Avram sent Eliezer out there to, you know, find her to begin with. Yeah?
Post hoc ergo.
Say something?
No,
sorry.
No, just that the punctuation would really be, in the English, it's a semicolon, and that was after it.
That is a great question. Copying over from the Bar Ilan, we don't really have the trump marks. That's what we're going to check right here. We got the handy dandy Kumash right next to me.
Biblical punctuation?
For lack of a better term, yeah.
Okay.
Because it helps set up the pausal forms, like when you stop in the middle. So, very good pickup. Didn't
also, post hoc ergo propter hoc. You know that, right?
Sure.
All student? After it, therefore, because of it.
Okay.
Well, that's like correlation causation.
Yes, exactly.
Sounds like a lot of hocking. So Naomi, very good pickup there. V'kachet Rivka v'tilo isha v'yahaveha v'etnachta, which is where the pasuk kind of has that pause, is on the yahaveha.
There you go.
Before v'yanachin.
Before.
Right. So that's where, if you're going to put in a comma, that's where it would be.
Well, anticipating the next source.
Mm-hmm.
I would point out that she became his wife before he's supposed to have loved her.
Yeah, okay, I'll take the next source since you already anticipated that one.
Then the next one is, Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel.
Right. Now, I think, I'm not sure if I mentioned the story here. I was in, my year in Gross, had a question and answer session with Ravar Lichtenstein. And someone in the kollel actually asked him if you were supposed to love your wife before you get married. And the reason why he asked the question was, you look at Yitzchak. Yitzchak got married, and then he loved her. Tihi lo le'isha v'yahaveh. Marriage came before love. Where so, you know, Ravarn was explaining this, and then someone in the back shouted out, oh, but with Yaakov it was the exact opposite. Which point Ravarn said, also true. yeah, he wasn't going to give the guy a straight answer on this one, but, you know, you do have, like, you know, with two of the, you know, Avot and Imahot couples, you do have the order kind of a little out of sync. Well, not out of sync, but you have a different order. So if you want to say that there is a reason why we're told they love them, maybe the point is the order. Maybe it's that, you know, there was marriage and then there was love, or first you have love, then you have love, then you have marriage. Perhaps one way is better, one way is worse. I don't know. Maybe love might not have that much of an important role in marriage. I mean, because as you mentioned earlier, Naomi, we're not never told that Avram loved Sarah. Says that, you know, he recognizes that she's beautiful, but we don't see that Ruth Ahav in connection.
Maybe it's not a value judgment. Maybe it's just an observation as to where things happen to different people.
That is I think that's a completely appropriate insight of way things happen, and we'll see how that develops. On page 2 here, these are two verses that my father likes quoting, and you know, this little thing I actually got from him. You compare Bereshit 29:11 and 29:25. After we know that, oh, I shouldn't say after we know. We're told in 29:18 that Jacob loved Rachel, right? So in 29:11, right before that pasuk, it says V'yishak Yaakov l'Rachel v'isa et kolo v'yev. When they first meet, things with the camels, Yaakov kisses Rachel, and you know he began to weep aloud. Fast forward to verse 25, after Lavan tricks Yaakov and gives him Leah instead, V'hi baboker v'hinehi Leah, that behold it is the morning. And it's Leah. Vayomer Lavan, Mazot Asitali, Halo Rachel Avati Imach Velama Rimitani. Why have you deceived me? Because I work for Rachel. So what my father likes pointing out here is this, right? You go through the sequence of events. One, Jacob kisses Rachel. Two, we're told he loves her. But three, the kiss, the physical interaction that they had, was clearly so insignificant that he couldn't tell the difference between Rachel and Leah.
He was not an observant Jew.
Well, I mean,
well, first of all, isn't it separated by 7 years?
Did he
work for those 7 years between? Didn't he like see her and then kiss her, and then he made this?
All right, well, let's go through.
And second of all, I mean, even if it was like a couple of days from then, without getting into the gory details, I mean, is it really that difficult to mistake?
Not really having first-hand experience in the matter, I don't know. I would like to think that, you know, if you do have some physical contact with someone, you probably ought to be able to recognize some difference, I suppose. Or at least, my father likes pointing out, it shows that the first interaction that he had with her wasn't really sexual. Could have been more social. But that's kind of his point, too, which is, I think, something interesting. That's only a good point here. No, you are right. We have Yaakov Rachel Sheva Shanim, right? So it might be able to argue that, you know, in 7 years you probably forgot what it was.
Or even 7 days.
Yeah, possibly.
If Yaakov knew Kolatora Kula,
then he should have been able to anticipate.
He should have been able. Well, wait a minute. How is it that he kissed her before they were married?
If he knew Kola Torakula, why was he marrying two sisters? Or, as the joke from the Extra Normal video went, if Jacob knew the entire Torah, why didn't he read a couple of chapters ahead and find out that Yosef was still alive?
Oh, I love that.
I'd rather not
he realize that.
That's a great question.
Leia.
Or that, exactly.
I forgot that one.
So, you know, I'd rather not rely on those types of things.
Okay.
At any rate, it does lead to, I think, an interesting, you know, dynamic control revisit. Take the next source. This is Bereshit 34:1-4. Fast forwarding a little bit ahead, but we see love used in a very different context than, you know, what we would consider as normal romantic love.
Yeah, my Hebrew name here. Vatetze dina bas lea asher yolda le Yaakov liros bivnos ha'aretz. Vayar osam shechem ben chamor hachivi nasi haaretz vayikach osa vayishkav osa vayaneha. Atid rak nafsho bedina bas Yaakov vayahav as hanara vayidaber alev hanara. Vayomer shechem el chamor aviv leimor kach li es hayalda hazos liisha. Now Dina, the daughter of Leah, had born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the land. When Shechem, son of Hamor, the Hivite, the ruler of that area, saw her, he took her and raped her. His heart was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. And Shechem said to his father, Hamor, get me this girl as my wife.
Right, so how would you define this type of ahava? And we're told, v'tibak nafsho b'dinah, his soul was connected strongly to her. Faya ahava tenara. Right? Same root, ahava. What do you think?
Either twisted or this guy's perception of what love is.
Mm-hmm. Explain.
Either he associates love with sexual contact.
Okay.
Or he figures, I'm going to give her the benefit of my expression of love, whether she wants it or not, because it's a wonderful thing. Neither of which is particularly good.
Yeah, this isn't a good story.
It shows maybe that the sense of the word includes a physical component.
Okay. Great point there. Maybe hava, includes in and of itself some physical component. Or, as Dana was saying, I think you could also argue that perhaps it's entirely subjective. Meaning that there is no universal term for what ahava means, what love means. It's really an emotion, and people can feel things differently. It's quite possible that Shechem, in his mind, felt love, but if you would apply that same metric to someone else, you'd say, this isn't really love, this is lust. Hey, welcome!
How old do we think Dina is when this happened?
I don't know, it just says Na'ara. Just says...
So it could be 12.
I guess. I wasn't there.
But theoretically, we could be talking about a pedophile.
Well, okay, so with this, don't forget that things were much different back then in terms of the rules of, pedophilia or something underage.
Well, 12 was a woman.
Exactly.
Okay, so right. By contemporary standards.
By contemporary standards, probably. I mean, when you're talking about when 12 is considered, the age of womanhood, and today I think... What's the lowest age of consent that
14
you know of?
14 is for marriage in Alabama.
And that's
14?
Wow.
I believe there's somewhere in the middle where it's still 14.
Wow. In New York, what's the statutory rate limit?
It's way older.
Way older, yeah.
Maybe like 16 or something?
Yeah, but then it's 16.
In New York?
But they have to be like 19 or 20. They can't be 18.
Right.
There's something like that.
There's an age gap.
Oh.
It's not like a 2-year thing. It's like a...
For obvious reasons, I shouldn't just say for obvious reasons, but you'll all be pleased to know these are not laws that I'm very well versed in. Point is, it would be quite different there.
Can I ask what does that mean? The English is he took her and raped her, but vishkav means to sleep.
Sleep with, well, right. So normally,
vianeo, what does that mean?
Really afflicted her, caused her pain, but also note the root here, it's not vishkav ima. It's not that he slept, with her. It's, really...
It's transitive.
In a sense, yeah. You actually, see it later with Vishkav et Bilha, with Reuven. When you're sort of, it's not something that you do with someone else. It's something where the other person is more an object.
Mean with her. Ota means her. He slept her. If you had to translate...
Kind of, yeah.
So Vishkav Ota...
Idiomatically means he slept. Well, idiomatically it means he slept with her, but from context it means especially with the I now was that there was actual force involved.
That's euphemistic.
Yeah. So going back to
from the text itself, I don't think.
What do you mean you don't need to derive it?
He slept with her and he caused her pain. That could be like
the first time
kind of thing.
So
there are other interpretations, no?
The Torah, often uses euphemisms for sexual relations in general.
Okay.
As far as, I hear what you're saying. Is there any possible way to interpret it that it wasn't rape?
Uniformly, so amongst the...
I'm trying to, I know of no commentator that puts it in that term and or had any interpreted this verse in any other way. I can see why you would say it, but I think it's retrojecting stuff into the verse. That's my sense.
Mm-hmm.
overall, we don't see a lot of the women's perspectives here as to whether they love their husbands.
True. Also, don't forget the brother's response to Yaakov at the end. Is she going to be like a harlot? Really, that just sleeps with her, and you can just pay her off, or pay us off on her behalf. All right, so we get back to Yaakov, and I included two verses here that kind of shows that love has a quantifiable element to it. Naomi, you want to take these? This is Bereishit 29:30, comparing with 37:3. Yeah.
Okay. Because he loves Rachel also, made an ornate room.
So we have Yaakov. You fast forward, from the earlier times that we had with Yaakov, is we've got two instances of Yaakov who would really give us the first instance of what we would call romantic love, of really just falling in love with a woman, working for 7 years. We also see that love can be a little bit qualifiable, where we're told explicitly he loved Rachel more than Leah. We're told he loved Yosef more than his other sons. Go back to the original sources that we did with Avram and Yitzhak, maybe the love of father to first son, even if it's not, guaranteed, it's, maybe it's not as much as you'd think it might be. So, something to keep in mind there also with the subjectivity of what love is. Leah, said that she felt to herself that she was sinua, that she was actually hated, which is a different perception, but at least as it's describing Yaakov, it's describing it as he loved one more than someone else. Right, so does that mean that he didn't love his other sons? Not necessarily, but there is some range of what the Torah will, how the Torah will use the term love. All right, so we're going to go to rabbinic two rabbinic sources for now. Carolyn, could you take next page 3? This is Mishnah Avot 2:3.
Be careful in your relations with the government, for they draw no man's hopes to themselves, except for their own interests. They appear as friends when it is to their advantage, but they do not stand by a man in his time of stress.
Yeah, I should confess here, none of these translations are mine. These were all, translations from elsewhere, but the word is nir'en ke'ohavin. Right, they appear as, using that root again of love, which shows that you could have an interpersonal relationship that's on one hand friendly based, as opposed to like governments don't have romantic love with other people except possibly Clinton and a few others. But the point is that there's a certain relationship there where it's nearing ke'ohavin. It seems as if they are close to you or friendly, but it's also conditional, which brings us to M. Avot 5:16.
Whenever love depends upon something and it passes, then the love passes away too. But if love does not depend upon some ulterior interest, then the love will never pass away. What is an example of the love which depended upon some material advantage? That of Amnon and Tamar. And what is an example of the love which did not depend on some ulterior interest? That of David and Jonathan.
Right, let me put this on pause. Okay, so, getting back here, passage of Amnon and Tamar is in Shmuel Bet, chapter 13. Let me read through the JPS translation quickly here. First the Hebrew, V'hiacharechein v'avshalom ben David, achot yafo shma Tamar, v'yahava Amnon ben David. It happened sometime afterwards, Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister named Tamar, and Amnon, son of David, became, the way it's described here, is infatuated with her, and eventually went on to rape her as well. Not as well that someone else did, but, did it with Dina. And actually, has a bit of a ruse and winds up loathing her afterwards, where the loathing was greater than the, quote, love that he felt for her. So that seems to be a love that is dependent on something. And it actually there uses the term love, even though, again, we might use the term lust, not unlike Shechem and Dina. Right? What I think is somewhat intriguing here, is that's clearly considered a bad form of love. It's considered love, but not good. And I think it's, really out of retrospect because of what it compels someone to do. It's when you have a desire for someone and it doesn't matter if they're going to reciprocate it. So the other person is more of an object. So you might call it love because this is how the only way you can identify the feeling. Very few people would say, oh, I'm lusting after someone, right? Because, for one thing, I don't think even if you are going to be that self-aware, you may not want to admit it or you may want to rationalize it to yourself. No, my feelings are be genuine when they quite very well might not be. In contrast, we have David and Jonathan, which is considered to be the love that is not dependent on anything, and it is la'ena batala la'olam, and cannot, you know, will not go away forever. So if you want to talk about, like, you know, it's odd that, you know, you have a mission that's talking about, like, almost the highest level of love, and it's between two men. Which, and the same root ahava that applies to, you know, other romantic relationships that we've seen, you know, is in this context. Nothing with the avot or imahot, even though, you know, we don't find it mentioned by Avram at all. We find one way by Yitzchak, another way by Yaakov, but that's not considered the highest level, even the love that Jacob had for Rachel. Yeah.
Socrates would agree.
Who would?
Socrates.
Okay, explain.
But, well, I mean, it's actually interesting. It occurs to me that this is a Mishnah and might perhaps be informed by some sort of Hellenistic, like, linking at the time.
Explain.
I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, it's been a while, but I know that in, I believe it's the Symposium, their conversation revolves around love. I think everyone has different opinions in that book, but kind of one of the ideals that comes out of that is like the love between a mentor and a student, and it's a, you know, and maybe that's sort of scrubbed clean a little bit the Mishnah into a non-sexual male love relationship.
Okay.
We're going to assume that David and Jonathan didn't have any sort of sexual relations.
All right.
And then, you know, like the love between a man and a woman, which is by necessity tainted with sexuality, is, I think, viewed probably on a lower level than that.
Wonderful. That's kind of on the way which eventually we're going to get to. So I think I'm assuming the Symposium says that, but I think it might be something which we may be able to find in the text here too. So for next several sources, all have to do with David and various forms of his love.
Well, so, I mean, the just to clarify, in the Symposium,
sure.
they were having sex.
Oh, okay.
But that's why I say it might be scrubbed clean by the Mishnah.
Possibly.
There are no Ruth references here, right?
No.
So do you believe there's a valid comparison between David and Yonasan and Ruth and Naomi?
See, this is the problem of not knowing Tanakh by heart. Let me double check if, you know, the root Av is used. I'm not seeing where that root Av is used to describe the relationship between Ruth and Naomi. I don't see that root Av. Meaning, you may describe today, like, you know, yes, they had a very close relationship. You might describe it as Ahava, but I don't see the word there.
Yeah.
Right,
they might have been BFFs.
I guess, and clearly she had, you know, a certain what we would call a human attachment to it. You know, whether or not you want to read into why was the word not used there, can leave that open for discussion. But I don't know.
Okay.
All right. So the next bunch of sources here are about, you know, David and this use of the word aha. So the first one is Yodavot David al Shaul v'yamod lefanav v'yaveu me'od v'ylo nosecheilin. That David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. So here we find the term ahav used, you know, in a more professional way. He liked the guy and, you know, gave him a good position. Dina, take the next two sources. This is when we have describing the actual relationship between David and Jonathan.
Vayehi kichal lo Saul ledaber el Shaul benefesh Yehonasan mikshara benefesh David vayavehu.
Yeah, that's a Korean seat there.
Okay, fine. Vayavehu Yehonasan kenafsho. Vayikachehu Shaul bayom hahu velo nesano leshuv beis aviv. Vayichros Yehonasan veDavid bris be'ava so oso kenafsho. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family, And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself.
Right. This is Shmuel Aleph 18:1-3. And to read Shmuel Aleph 20:16-17.
Okay. Vayechrosya nasan im beis David uvikesh yekovak miyad ayve.
Uvikesh Hashem. That's God. That's how they write.
Really?
God's name. Yeah.
Uvikesh Hashem miyad ayve David.
Yeah.
Vayosef Yonason lashbia es David ba'avaso oso ki avas nafsho ahevo. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord May the Lord call David's enemies to account." And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him because he loved him as he loved himself.
Okay. Now, it's good that you read in the Hebrew, because you'll notice, you know, with the Ahava, what other word is attached to this word love in the Hebrew? As a kind of as a modifier.
Me'od.
Well, not just me'od just means a lot, but something that's repeated.
Nafsho.
You've got various idioms of nefesh, which the English translation I got here translates as love him as himself, and it's actually said, nefesh Yonatan nikshara b'nefesh David, that, you know, the soul of Jonathan was connected to the nefesh, the soul of David. Turn back to the thing with Dina and Shem. It's the same word of nefesh, but what's an important difference in terms of the verb? Give you a hint, it's in verse number 3. I didn't put it in English. And the English translation here doesn't do it that well. In Bereshit 34:1-4, it's actually verse 3, it's v'tidbak nafsho bedina. The word dabak means really to be stuck to or connected with, as opposed to nikshara. What do you think is the difference?
He was stuck on her.
Uh-huh, as opposed to nikshara.
Stuck as opposed to tied or
yep.
bonded?
Yeah. And what do you think is the obvious difference?
Mutuality.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, say
no,
that again.
You're both right.
Yes, nodding is mutual.
Like, this is like together, this is like together.
Oh,
together.
Okay.
When it's Mitzhara B'Nefesh David, it means there's a certain type of interconnectedness, like a knot. Whereas what, you know, Shem was feeling was more of, I'm sticking to her. It's a one-way type of connection. It's, I really, really need her, as opposed to actually caring what she feels in this process. Which, you know, you would kind of expect that she wouldn't.
Where is the phrase that
Hidbat l'shoni l'chiki?
In reference to what?
Imashkachek Yerushalayim, if I forget the O Jerusalem.
Okay, so then wouldn't you apply the same... I don't know, if...
Well, that's
if I forget Jerusalem, my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth.
You'll notice or using the visual aid there. When you have something that sticks, you've got piece A, piece B, they come together. Like, think about how your tongue sticks to your mouth. Mm. You don't say, I mean, yes, we use an idiom tongue-tied, but that means something else. But when your tongue sticks to the top of your mouth, think of it as like being cemented with like peanut butter, right? Where they're not really interconnected, it's just, you know, they're really just stuck there. Whereas when you take like two pieces of rope and you tie them together, right, what you've done is you've created a new entity of connectedness, where both are so interconnected it's hard to tell where one begins and one ends.
But are we not similarly?
Well, the word there isn't being used to describe our connection to Jerusalem. It's being used to
describe what it's a metaphor of what should happen to you if you forget.
Okay.
It's your tongue should stick to your mouth. If your tongue gets tied to the top of your mouth, that would require painful surgery. I wouldn't recommend it.
I don't know. It seems like I'm going off the wrong page here, but the image of Jerusalem is really much present in my mind because of, isn't Jerusalem described as feminine?
Mm.
She's raped, or she's left alone, or she's a widow. I don't know.
But the tzedakah there isn't about connecting to Jerusalem. It's about what goes on in your mouth.
Okay.
In the imagery. Turn to the final page. For a sake of comparison, about David, and say, you know, we had like Shoah loves David. Here are two other instances of David, one more explicitly with Ahava, and one possibly not. Naomi, take Shmuel Aleph 18. This is verses 18-21.
So David said to Saul, mine, and when does my family or my clan should become the king's?
Mm-hmm.
So when the time came for Merah, he was given in marriage to Adriel, daughter Michal,
Right. So here, operatively, it says to have Michal bat Shaul et David. Michal loved David. We have no indication that David reciprocated. Right. So it seems to be one way. Take it a step further. Here's a very interesting, you know, passage where, notably, the word ahava is not used. This is Shmuel Bet 11:2-4.
One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around the roof. He saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah." David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her month. Then she went back home.
Right? Note what we're missing. The word ahava. Right? In this, you know, from whatever people want to describe of, you know, a romantic love story of David and Bathsheba, I think it's curious at the moment, the word ahava is not used. I mean, this seems to be lust, not unlike, say, Amnon and Tamar, or Shechem and Dinah, and yet the word ahava is conspicuously absent. And I personally find that very interesting.
I mean, the story of David and Bathsheba is not at all, like, commendable.
Mm-hmm. True.
I mean, the David from start to finish.
Yeah. And, so, he gets yelled at for it pretty badly.
And also, I forgot which Haftorah it is, but one of the Haftorahs, David HaMelech was ill,
mm-hmm.
and they brought him a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy kind of finds...
But notably, they did not have relations, which is the Pasuk also says.
Really?
Yeah, hold on a second, I'll look this up. Okay, so here it is. It's at the very beginning of Melachim Aleph. Right, he was old. They covered him with clothing, and he never felt warm. And they said, "Oh, we'll get you, you know, woman." So they brought him into Uat Avishag Hashunamit, Vayaviu Atalamelk. So he found Avishag Hashunamit, brought her to the king. Then Nara Yafa Ad Meod, Vati Melch Sochenet, Vatishrateu, Vamelch Lo Yadah. That the girl was exceedingly beautiful. She became the king's attendant, waited upon him, but the king was not intimate with her. So that would be a very important distinction there as well. So there, not only do you have no ahava, you also have no relations. So kind of gives us here like an interesting...
They snuggled.
I suppose. You know, this gives you a very, you know, so far we see somewhat of an interesting range of how the word ahava is used. Where the most idyllic one seems to be between David and Jonathan. Even with David himself and his, you know, other relationships, you know, ahava is used either one way in terms of Michal loving him, we don't know if he reciprocated. And with Bathsheba, or at least the initial encounter, seems to be somewhat devoid of ahava. There's a professional ahava, professional love he has with Shaul. Going back to some of the earlier sources that we've seen, could either be something that's, you know, a term of affection or endearment, or it could mean a form of romantic love, or it could mean something that today we may consider more analogous to lust. I think this goes back to what Jacob said earlier, that there is such a subjective range of what love is going to mean for each individual person. Even if we may consider it love, that doesn't mean someone else will, or vice versa. Deep infatuation, maybe it's considered love, maybe it's not. It's quite possible that the reason why it doesn't say that David loved Bathsheba is, well, compared to what? If you compare it to, say, David and Yonatan, well, would that really be considered ahava? Right, because you're talking about two very different models. When you're dealing with, say, Yaakov and Rachel and Leah, to say he loved Rachel more than Leah, or he loved one son more than another son, it's almost like if you can set up a grid with an equation with variables, right? You would assume that the type of love someone would have for their son would be X, and such they'd all be comparable, right? The love that someone has for a child, hopefully, is not the love that one has for a spouse. You will still use that term love, but I so hope they mean very different things. You know, so it's at least then you can have some point of comparison. With David, his main point of comparison was Yonatan. And based on what you were saying earlier from the symposium, it could very well be that the reason why, as a possibility, that David and Yonatan's love was so great was because of the lack of ulterior motives. In fact, with Yonatan, it really meant helping out David meant he was going to lose his own monarchy, right? Because Saul was the king, you know, after, you know, king dies, son takes over, that would have been Jonathan. So, you know, by him helping David, then he's actually, you know, shooting himself in the foot, not literally shot the arrow elsewhere. But the fact that there is no physical nature to it as well. Because even with any physical relationship, you might say there's some ulterior motive involved, even if it is the heter, even if it is completely permissible or part of kiddushin, or it's part of whatchamacallit, even if it's part of marriage. I know we did a source in one of the other classes here. Gemara says that when rabbis prayed to take away the yetzer hara, take away the inclination for sexual immorality, and they weren't able to find an egg, right? Saying that, like, yes, you know, even though we don't believe in original sin, there seems to be, you know, that creative need that people have that, you know, drives, libido, whatever you want to call it. Perhaps that's enough of a taint to say, well, it's not to the level of nefesh kishura b'nafsho, or it may even be hard to get there when you have, you know, there are other needs that come into play. It could very well be that the idyllic relationship of David and Jonathan was, well, we're not getting anything out of this, and that, you know, we're just so intertwined, you know, there's no other reason for it. Any thoughts on that? No? Well, something to consider. Got two more sources here. One is a Gemara in Sanhedrin 7a, that even though it doesn't use the term ahava, uses the term rechamtan, I just thought it was, you know, an interesting source to throw in. Jacob?
Another used to say, when love was strong, we could have made our bed on a sword blade. Now that our love has grown weak, a bed of 60 cubits is not large enough for us.
Oh. Yeah. Kind of a difference about, you know, how, you know, when you love someone, you know, it, you can, you know, make your bed on, like, a, you know, the tiniest, you know, point. Otherwise, you know, the biggest, you know, there's just not enough space for the two of you. Which kind of ties into this pasuk from Mishlei 10:12, which I must confess is one of my favorite pasukim. Sinat ta'orer medanim ve'al kol pesha'im tachaseh ahava. Hatred stirs up conflict, but love covers all wrongs. Context is means if you hate someone, you're going to find things that are going to take you off about that person. And you'll, you know, say, ah, oh, he's doing this wrong, he's doing this wrong. Good example is, you know, listen to any Democrat on anything Obama does, right? No matter what he does, you're going to find people on the right who are going to say, he's doing this wrong, he's getting this wrong, you know, he should have done this, he should have done that. Had he done the other thing, they would have complained, oh, you should have done X, Y, or Z. It's, you dislike someone for, or, and you could do the same thing with Bush too when he was in office, that when you just don't like the guy, you're always going to find some fault in what he does. You don't really care if it makes sense. It's, how do I get this guy? But on the flip side, when you love someone, person can't really do any wrong. And you think about how often, you know, we hear the idiom of people get blinded by love, or people get involved in relationships where, you know, they clearly don't see that something is really wrong here.
Not Percy Sledgehammer. When a man loves a woman, she can do no wrong.
There you go. Wonderful reference there. And to the Percy Sledge, omitting the Michael Bolton reference. So extra points for that, too. Going back to
him. Oh, yeah, he did.
He did. He did. But thank you very much for quoting the original. Much appreciated. But I think it's true, you know, for any one of us who's been in that situation, you know, where people just get walked all over by someone, you know, in really worst cases, you know, someone who can get abused. Because when you love someone, it's not... You know, it can be blinding. It could have a type of, you know, nefesh kishurah b'nafsho, you know, when you're really intertwined. But on the other hand, if it's so taken over about you, then it's not really about the other person. It's about fulfilling a certain really visceral need that you have that's compelling you to do things. It's how you can have this word ahava used in the context of a rape, or two rapes actually, with Amnon and Tamar, and with Shechem and Dinah. Which is not something that you would normally associate with the same word ahava that you have with Yaakov and Rachel. Right? So it could very well be that this term ahava is referring to something that is very subjective, and it's less speaking about an idyllic state in general, or at least as a human being, as much as we're all going to experience it differently based on our relationships. And, you know, as we introduce this, as you have this neshama lekecha, you know, assuming it refers to having an emotional feeling towards God, well, just as how we love other people is going to vary, both in terms of the nature of the relationships between family members, children, spouses, friends, employees, employers, and the like. Our relationship with God can also be different as well. It's just there's no other word to capture. What does this mean, ahava? And this is really the best that we can do. And I think, though, it allows everyone to sort of explore ahava as they see fit. Any thoughts on that? Cool. Rebuttals?
It's interesting when you get back to the as they see fit, to get back to the fact that it is used for rape.
Okay. So. Well, when I say but I say as they see fit, I mean more of, you know, all right. So I clearly I should explain them because I really didn't mean it like that. But it could very well mean yes, he did in his mind. You know, this is what he did, but it was still wrong. So if anything, it could also hold you, you know, keep in mind that, you know, just because you have certain feelings and they might feel good doesn't necessarily mean you want to act on them. Because after all, emotions are emotions. That could also be part of the point here, too. You know, ahava is not, you know, for some people it's still like all you need is love. Right? I don't think that's it, because if love can be confused as lust based on context, right? You wouldn't want someone to pursue that, or certainly not in that way here. I mean, did Shem really love her? He might have felt that way. You know, does that mean it's any less?
Also, he didn't say so.
Would you take it back?
The text doesn't say anything about love till after the rape.
Yeah.
So.
True.
I don't know, it's all kind of twisted.
It is kind of twisted, but the truth is, love can sometimes be that way. If anyone sees just like really dysfunctional relationships, the ones that are abusive, it could very well be that someone does, you know, they do it in the name of love, or it could be, is it that they really love another person, or they love the fact that they can control someone else. And, you know, emotions might be the same, but, you know, you try describing what is love, and you just can't. It's why you've got a whole lot of really lousy songs about that, you know, trying to figure this out, because, you know, it's something that's really indescribable at the end of the day. In general, I don't think... love is, you know, it's certainly not something that the Torah rejects altogether. I do think it's more an issue of a human condition and is of a human emotion. It's something that people are going to experience. The Torah tells you to do certain things and not do certain things. Loving God can be done in many ways, right? Loving other people can also be done in many ways. Certain things are more healthy or healthier than others. But it is a human emotion that sometimes people feel and sometimes they won't feel. And it's not something, you know, like any good cognitive behavioral therapist, you know, will tell you. You can't be in control over your emotions. They're going to come or they're going to go, but you can be in control of what you do with them. And I think if you can understand what are the dimensions of love, and to know that just because you feel a certain affection towards someone doesn't really mean that's necessarily love. Or it could be, you know, taking it back to Yonatan and David, that the real love that you have is going to be reciprocated. It's not that you love someone else and they don't love you back, but the one where it's really nefesh, you know, nefesh kishurav nafsho, when you've got like one soul really integrated with another, you know, could very well be the idyllic form of love that, you know, the Torah is trying to, I mean, slowly nudge us into. Anyway, thank you all very much, and happy Valentine's Day.